brought to you by the Cannabis Bee Network.
Here is the Cannabis Entrepreneur Show with your host, Scott Jacobs.
Hello, listeners. How's it going today? This is the Cannabis Entrepreneur News, episode 012-417-2014. Yeah, I've been a little busy lately. I haven't produced an episode in a couple of weeks, but I'm going to get back on track and start giving you an episode once a week. All right, let's roll into article number one. Mark Emery, Prison Blog, The Origins of Pot TV. Take it away.
Mark Emery, Prison Blog, The Origins of Pot TV in 2000. By Mark Emery. Source, Cannabis Culture Marijuana Magazine. Hemp BC, our original retail store that opened on July 2, 1994 at 324 West Hastings Street in Vancouver, launched the first cannabis website in the world on September 30, 1994. The World Wide Web had gone live in August of 1994, and now websites could actually be created and put online. In fact, our launch party for HempBC was shared at a location where our HempBC site was launched in tandem with CBC.ca, Canada's largest national TV and radio network. We were the 8th and 9th websites in Vancouver to go live, and in those days, a big gala party was held to announce a website going live, just like an art gallery opening. Within a few months, with thousands of websites flooding online in every community, you never saw website launch parties ever again. Those innocent days. We had perhaps 200 people come to this joint launch party for CBC.ca and HempBC.com. Our website CannabisCanada.com went online 4 months later, first as a link on the HempBC site. Pot TV was the first website in the world devoted to exclusively video, and the first website devoted to cannabis video. This project turned out to be very costly, and the production, distribution and reception of streamed video was technologically challenging, although the technological challenges of archive video were less so. Here is the story about how Pot TV came to be. After four raids from January 4, 1996 to September 2, 1998 on HempBC, Mark Emery Direct Seeds, The Cannabis Cafe, and Cannabis Culture Magazine, I had retreated to living on the Sunshine Coast of BC. I would go to Vancouver every week on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to pick up the mail to Mark Emery Seeds, and then hunker down in a windowless 6x15-foot office at 21 Water Street that was previously the storage room for Cannabis Culture magazine, and there I would answer seed inquiries by phone and email. Despite the four raids, I had not discontinued selling seeds and, in fact, I put all my efforts into expanding the seed business and using those profits to expand Cannabis Canada magazine into a larger circulating magazine that was now, by 1999, distributed into the United States and Canada as Cannabis Culture. In October 1999, a person I had never met contacted me over the phone and said that I should consider a cannabis video website. I said I had never seen video on a website, or anywhere on the internet. This was true, there was not yet any video online, and asked what he meant. He said, theoretically it's possible. I said, well, how would we make that happen? He said, you would bring me to Canada and get me to put it together for you. This hustler was a fellow named Lance, from New Jersey. I had never heard of him, and he wasn't with me long. He had addiction issues that really came to the fore once he arrived penniless on the Sunshine Coast. But he had sent me a list of equipment we would need to buy, and we agreed I would bring him to the Sunshine Coast and he would put it together, and we would make the hitherto never before done video content for a video website all about cannabis. I bought up all this tech equipment, and on the morning of January 1, 2000, the equipment was spread out on the floor of the downstairs of my 9th Street home in the Bonnybrook neighborhood of Gibson's on the Sunshine Coast. Lance had just arrived a few days earlier. I paid for a one-way flight from somewhere on the U.S. East Coast to Vancouver. Lance was a character, with a few days stubble always on his chin, and Jewish Brooklynese patter with speaking. He liked cigars, and pot and heroin too, which I discovered within about 8 or 9 weeks, to my dismay. He was addicted, and always in a kind of rag desperation, though at the time I couldn't pinpoint quite why. But now he was on the payroll. I looked at him on January 1st, and with my website tech guy Carlos, I said to the two of them, okay, make it happen. I remember that day well. At least 30 or 40 switches, motherboards, microphones, video cameras, computer parts, stuff for the most part I had no idea what they were or what they did, were on the carpet of the Pot TV studio waiting to be assembled into something that worked. they set about building the studio in my basement. Some basement. This studio area looked out through floor-to-ceiling windows onto a gorgeous view of the Pacific Ocean, Douglas fir trees, a walking trail along the sea. It was a very idyllic and bucolic setting for the world's first video website. While Lance and Carlos worked on this theoretically possible idea of a video streaming cannabis video website, I set about to branding it. Our first domain name acquisition was pot.tv.net, and our first slogan was "You're watching the pot.tv internet network," which became pot.tv, as high as you can get on the net. In 2001, I found out that the island nation of Tuvalu had offered its national domain address .tv out to anyone, most likely TV networks, who wanted to pay a premium to get the .tv domain extension. At first they announced they wanted $10,000 per domain extension, but that got no takers. Then I was informed that Tuvalu had decided to sell annual .tv extension rights for $500 a year, and one of my happiest days was when we successfully got the pot.tv domain name in February. In March, while working on the development of pot.tv and figuring out how it would work and realizing there were obstacles to overcome that seemed insurmountable, I saw two or three news websites from major television networks having one or two short 30 to 60 second clips appear in archive video form on their largely text sites. These were the first examples I had seen of what was possible. Downloading them was difficult, time-consuming, and playback was herky-jerky. Even our latest computer struggled to process the volume of data required to play back the video. That was our first intimation of trouble. Our plans were to stream live video, for hours on end, like a TV broadcaster, but only on the web. Oddly, I had not really considered archive video, just a continual stream of live content, until I saw this kind of playback anytime style of presentation called archive video. I hadn't really considered any of the obstacles that existed, like costs of webcasting, all that bandwidth, the ability of modems and computers to process large volumes of bandwidth live or data archive. On January 1st, I just presumed it was possible and our organization should do this project. That was how I always thought about any project: commit now, and figure out the details as we went along. This usually resulted in the project getting done, but requiring much greater time, resources, an expense than I had counted on. It's a dangerous way to do anything in business, but that's why I'm an entrepreneur and not so much a businessman. If I knew the costs, obstacles, and actual difficulties involved in projects like the Cannabis Cafe, North America's first vapor lounge I opened July 2, 1997 at a cost of $300,000 and 8 months, though the initial budget was $60,000 and 3 months, pop.tv, Toker's Bowl 2002-2005, I would likely have never done them. In fact, I'm certain I would never have attempted them. I was told that our online videos would have to be produced using proprietary video browser formats. A player called RealPlayer was launched so video could be streamed or played on your computer. To produce video by this just-announced company, RealPlayer would cost $8,000 for a production license, so we got it. Problems Douglas. By March, the project was going slowly, Lance was behaving erratically, and I was told that live streamed video might not be possible. One of the problems was that the amount of bandwidth almost everyone in North America had back then was received by dial-up through the telephone lines, not through a dedicated modem. We were fortunate that in January of 2000 the Sunshine Coast was one of the first jurisdictions in Canada to have high-volume fiber optic cables, allowing for the use of dedicated modems hooked directly into the network. For our first official live stream show, advertised on CannabisCulture.com and featured as exclusive content at pop.tv, people tuned in on their computers to watch video cannabis history being made, and told us that they just received one image frozen for about 5-20 seconds with a scratch of the audio, so that it was unwatchable. So, theoretically, people could receive our live-streamed webcasts if they could receive much higher volumes of bandwidth, which virtually none of them could. Within days we realized that an uninterrupted audio stream could get through clearly on pop.tv, so on March 23rd we started regular daily program of what amounted to pop.tv radio, with Richard Cowan webcasting the cannabis news, our first pop.tv production. It was a 30-minute to 1-hour daily live show, and in its own way, it was thrilling enough. But it wasn't what I imagined as pop.tv. Then Carlos and Lance determined that if we made a video show, and then made it an archive video, not live, it would be permanently available on the pod.tv site, and downloadable onto computers, and then once all the data was downloaded onto the receiving computer, it could be played on that receiving computer anytime using RealPlayer. That worked and we went with it. Soon I discovered that Lance had serious heroin addiction problems, and one day while he was in the downtown east side of Vancouver, he lost our expensive video camera. Our one camera. So we bought out Lance's contract with a paid $4,000 car in June 2000, and he drove back to the U.S. East Coast. Lance was a lot of trouble and worry, but he did put the marijuana video website idea in my head, so for that I'm thankful. All across North America, and in other parts of the world more slowly, homes and offices were getting faster bandwidth access, and people move away from telephone line reception to dedicated modem lines on fast-developing fiber optic networks. But in May 2000, it took many people 15 minutes to up to 6 hours to download a 15-minute video show from pod.tv. And most shows we did were 15 minutes to 60 minutes long, the average being about 30 minutes. These shows used up expensive amounts of bandwidth in the early years, and there was a problem with that. As the shipper of these high-bandwidth programs, pod.tv had to bear the costs. That was one of two major reasons no one had ever done it before, the cost of that bandwidth, and the inability of most modems through telephone lines to receive that volume of bandwidth quickly enough. The following year, 2001, USA Today gave a plug to pod.tv as the pioneering video website of the cannabis world, and our monthly bandwidth costs were already $8,000 minus $10,000. By 2002, pod.tv bandwidth was $15,000 per month and nearly $200,000 for the year. Each time a person watched a one-hour show in that early era, it cost pod.tv 10-30 cents. The more popular we became, the more our costs rocketed up. And there was little way to monetize the product the shows on pod.tv, except for video ads for Mark Emery Direct Seeds. That is what subsidized pod.tv. From 2000 to July 29, 2005, when Mark Emery Seeds was busted by the DEA and their Vancouver police lackeys. Emery Seeds provided $890,000 to finance pod.tv in those 6 years. In May 2000, Richard Cowan was doing a daily news video show you could download to your computer. By that summer, pod.tv was run by Chris Bennett, who did a show on cannabis and religion called Burning Shiva. Other shows quickly developed. By May 2001, shows were being recorded in a dedicated studio at 307 West Hastings Street in the BC Marijuana Party Building, and I started my Prince of Pot show that month, which was a kind of weekly bi-weekly show of me fulminating over the issues of the day. Over the years, the Pot TV News, a Pot.TV staple throughout 5.5 years, was done by Steve and Michelle Cubby, Loretta Noll, Chris Bennett and others. By 2005, Pod.tv was doing a massive cannabis judging contest in a 10-part series called The Contest, where we solicited marijuana samples to be sent us in the mail, and we received over 140 different samples. Watch that epic series here link. Not a single sample sent to us went missing in the mail or intercepted by police, despite or because of the fact we were unknowingly being surveilled by Vancouver police, the DEA, the RCMP, the U.S. Justice Department and Canada's Justice Ministry when the contest was being recorded in the pod.tv studio in the months prior to the bust of July 29, 2005. Once Mark Emery Seeds was busted, and bail conditions on me prohibited me from continuing to sell seeds, and all the enterprises that relied on the profits of Emery Seeds were in big trouble. This included the Cannabis Culture magazine, and the BCMP bookstore formerly HempBC. All had to become self-sufficient or perish. Without the 12-page catalog that Mark Emery Seeds paid Cannabis Culture $35,000 an issue to put in, the magazine was in dire trouble. But it downsized its staff from 11 to 6, moved its office to the basement of the retail store essentially free rent, and managed to survive and publish a great magazine until it was evident I was going to prison for 5 years. Once I had accepted a plea bargain with the U.S. prosecutors, we announced that Cannabis Culture magazine would cease publication in early 2009, and we refunded everyone whatever money they had remaining in their subscriptions. The magazine took up huge amounts of my and Jody's lives and energy, and it still lost $10,000 minus $20,000 an issue, which the retail store changed from being called the BCMP to CCHQ Cannabis Culture Headquarters in 2008, would have to earn to cover. To replace me, the editor, with a hired hand would have simply have been too burdensome on the store and Jody, so we agreed to fold the magazine after 82 issues, 5 of the Marijuana and Hemp Newsletter, 12 of Cannabis Canada, 63 of Cannabis Culture and 3 Best of Cannabis Culture, with time to refund people any money owed them. My only regret in that regard was for the people who had lifetime subscriptions, about 15 people, including five guys in a rock band in North Carolina who had the CC logo tattooed on their bodies, because in previous years we offered a lifetime subscription to anyone who tattooed a Pod.TV or CC logo on themselves. Pod.TV pioneered some groundbreaking shows, which are still available to be seen online. Then CC editor Dana Larson did shows with himself taking LSD, or smoking DMT, or smoking pot and driving a vehicle, while a camera recorded him the entire time. The LSD show is, in fact, the most interesting show Pod.TV ever did. Unfortunately, when Dana was running for parliament many years later, this video was discovered by the media and used by the NDP to pressure him into resigning his nomination. Another thing used to get Dana to resign was a photo of him with approximately 100 joints in his mouth, a photo we took when we rolled about 1,000 joints for the Chris Bennett and Renee Boge wedding celebration. I love that photo, it's so wonderfully outrageous, but so politically incorrect, I guess. No place for a sense of humor in Canadian politics. All shows from 2001 to 2005 were done by Chris Bennett and a quiet fellow named Ian as full-time staff members of Pod.TV, and for their time, they were excellent shows. Once the bust of Mark Emery Seeds occurred, there was no money for Pod.TV, and it languished for a few years. It was in 2006 when Flash Media debuted, and YouTube's shrewd exploitation of Flash made video transmission hundreds of times cheaper to send over the internet. YouTube became our distributor of video material, greatly reducing the cost of archive video, and Pod.TV content slowly re-emerged. By 2012, Livestream made live video shows practical, which were then archived. Mind you, whereas Pod.TV had a virtual cannabis video monopoly from 2000 to 2005 due to prohibitive bandwidth expense, now there are thousands of cannabis videos recorded each week from around the world, all competing for eyeballs to watch them, sponsored by YouTube, Google and their advertisers. Pod.TV produced over 6,000 archive video shows from 2000 to 2006, at a great cost financially but with an immeasurable benefit to the millions of viewers who have been watching our shows worldwide.
Article number 2, Florida Entrepreneur Bets on Legal Medical Pot. Take it away.
Florida Entrepreneur Bets on Legal Medical Pot. By Colleen Michelle Jones. Source, Upstart Business Journal. Florida has yet to legalize medical marijuana. But that hasn't stopped Donovan Carr from starting his weed-related business. Jacksonville's Donovan Carr is aiming high with his new business venture. Betting that marijuana will be big business in Florida if the drug is legalized for medical use in November, Carr founded the Cannabis University of Florida in Jacksonville 3 months ago. About a month ago, he began advertising seminars for those who want to learn to grow and learn the biz on his website, cannabisuniversityfl.com. Learn the Biz is a one-day class offered on Saturdays and Sunday. Learn to Grow is held on weekdays once a week for 4 weeks. Both classes, which cost $499 and $299 respectively, are already sold out through May. The sessions are held at hotels in the Jacksonville area, which Carr said has not led to problems. These kinds of classes have been held statewide and across the country at hotels of every kind, from Fortune 500s down, said Carr, a retired former New Yorker. It's not as controversial anymore. Although voters still have to make a decision on the medical marijuana law, demand for knowledge about what many believe will be a new HMM budding industry is high. It's opening up a lot of opportunities for people that weren't there before, and there is the hope that it will bring in a lot of money for the state, said Carr. And people want to get an idea of what's coming in the future. Conferences and organizations like Carr's are helping others prepare for entrepreneurship in Florida's potential cannabis market. Last month, about 100 people showed up in West Palm Beach for a conference on the business, and in November, some 1,500 cannabis entrepreneurs and major investors are expected at the third edition of a national conference in Las Vegas. A number of entrepreneurs in Central Florida have been seeking to jump into the growth industry, as chronicled by the Orlando Business Journal. There's work in dispensaries, security, delivery, cultivation, you name it, Carr said. Carr, who said he's dabbled in real estate, finance and the hospitality industry in his 30-year career, spent the last couple of years in California, the first state to approve medical marijuana. That doesn't mean he partakes, I don't use it. I tried it once and didn't like the effect it had on me, he said. Though his university doesn't have any specific credentials or license, Carr said the dozen or so speakers he hires to lead his seminars have expertise in a variety of fields, including law, medicine, venture capitalism, finance and a multitude of other areas where the sanctioned sale of marijuana would intersect. Then there's the horticulture process itself, learning to grow, maintain and harvest the plant, all demonstrated by a master gardener. Of course, with the law not yet changed, the speakers aren't hauling their favorite alien OG or blueberry yum yum specimen into class for demonstration purposes. We're just using tomatoes and peppers for now, Carr said with a laugh.
Article number 3. Big money investors descend upon cannabis company pitch network in Boston. Take it away.
Big money investors descend upon cannabis company pitch network in Boston. By Juliet Fairley. Source, Main Street. Adam Guild paid $5,000 to attend the ArcView Group Investor Network in Boston this week. The entrepreneur wants to coordinate a group of investors to create a mutual fund for the cannabis industry, as well as potentially sell his company Herbalist.com to a larger investor. The Investor Network is a great opportunity because there's so many players in one room, Guild told Main Street. It's my first time attending an ArcView conference, but I've already noticed a high level of professionalism. The legal national cannabis market is estimated to be a $1.5 billion industry, with companies that will grow more than 68% to $2.6 billion in 2014 alone. As a result, Guild need not worry about the quality of investor and entrepreneurs that are pitching at the Arcade View Group Investor Network. About 10% of attending investors are also entrepreneurs seeking funding for their own cannabis venture. We have a number of people who are investors and entrepreneurs because investors want to be diversified, said Troy Dayton, co-founder of the ArcView Group, an investment and research firm in San Francisco. They may need another round of financing or want to diversify their portfolio. They don't want to spend all of their own money even if they have money. They are looking for strategic investors, and most are very involved in the sector. For example, in addition to getting a sense of merger and acquisition prospects, Guild is looking to invest $100,000 into a cannabis company presenting at the Investor Network.
Article number 4. 5 Surprising Realities of Legal Weed. Take it away.
5 Surprising Realities of Legal Weed. By Donna Fuscaldil. Source, Entrepreneur.com. If you build it, they will come has clearly been the case for small businesses in Colorado, one of the first states to legalize the recreational use of marijuana. But the demand, which has outstripped many lofty expectations, is not the only thing small business owners in the pot gold rush are surprised about. The demand and growth has been a huge surprise, says Bob Eschino, co-founder of Medically Correct in Denver, Colorado, which makes a line of cannabis-infused chocolate bars called Incredibles. I've never seen anything like this, and I've owned a business for the last 15 years. Selling 40,000 chocolate marijuana bars a month. Colorado and Washington, the first states to legalize recreational marijuana, could be called the U.S. guinea pigs on the business of cannabis. While many states are resistant to this new industry and it is still illegal on the federal level, companies growing and selling marijuana and ones that support them are seeing so much demand they can hardly keep up. Consider Medically Correct. According to Eschino, his company, which supplies medical dispensaries in Colorado, is selling 40,000 chocolate marijuana bars a month and doesn't have enough of the pot ingredients to meet the demand. Medically Correct's chocolate bars sell for $6 at the medical dispensaries and almost $10 in the retail market. Banks not cashing in. While the demand is huge, Eschino says that's not the only thing that caught him off guard about his business. Given the size of the market and the opportunity to profit, the lack of interest from banks to lend to marijuana businesses is eye-opening, he says. In February, the U.S. Department of Justice and the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, a unit of the U.S. Department of Treasury, gave banks guidelines for working with legal marijuana businesses, yet financial institutions are still resistant to the industry. We were hoping the statements from the federal government would have some teeth, says Eschino. But investors aren't avoiding this business. Eschino says he gets cold calls on a regular basis from venture capitalists, angel investors, and others looking to get in on the pot gold rush. Everybody wants to get into the business, but they come in and undervalue our company, he says. Don't say it's not your father's weed. For Peter Johnson of Colorado Green Tours, which gives both consumers and investors tours of the Colorado pot business, the client demographic has surprised him. Most people would assume people visiting Colorado because of the pot industry would be 20-something-year-olds looking to legally get high. But it turns out, a lot of the clientele signing up for the tours, which start out at around $200 and can get much pricier, are baby boomers. The demographic is considerably older than I had assumed it would be prior to doing research, says Johnson. There are an awful lot of old hippies that are very happy to live to see this day. And it's not only the baby boomers that want a tour of this up-and-coming business. Johnson says he also gets a lot of interest from investors, and is somewhat surprised larger companies are trying to cash in as of yet. This is a very large and now pretty lucrative market, he says. That was quick. Travis Howard, co-founder of Green Dream Health Services in Boulder, Colorado, trained himself early on to expect the unexpected when it comes to legal marijuana, but one area that he was caught off guard by was the speed in which the state moved to allow the sale of recreational marijuana. We knew it would go recreational but thought it would be closer to 2016, says Howard, whose company operates dispensaries and provides consultations on getting into the pot business. We thought we would get 5 to 7 years of the medical business under our belt before adding something else to the plate. Government's take. Another area that surprised Howard is the sales tax that has been imposed on the purchase of pot. According to Travis, in Boulder the total tax is 36% and in Denver it's in the high 20% range, a far cry from the 6% sales tax in Denver and 8.5% sales tax in Boulder. Howard had figured it would move to 10% or 15%, but not as high as it is. It's the first time I'm hearing from the grow supply stores and nutrient supply stores that the black market growers are thinking there's an opportunity for them to get back into the industry, says Howard, noting because of the tax rate in 1/8 of weed will cost $60 to $70 legally, but $40 to $50 on the black market. While many small business owners are waiting for the day it will be legal in their state, running a pot business requires a lot of capital, which the banks aren't willing to lend. Because of that, Ashino of Medically Correct says small business owners have to think long and hard before they make a foray into this industry. Right now it's difficult unless you have a whole bunch of disposable income, he says. You get no line of credit and even though it's a profitable business every penny goes back in. We can grow quicker if we get access to more capital, but we can't.
All right, listeners, that's all I have for this episode. Until next episode, have a good day, good night, good week. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.